Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 26th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. We're going to be talking all about irritable bowel syndrome. We may have found why so many people have problems with their gut. The Bash Street Kids, do you remember them? Fatties being changed to Freddy because body image campaigners say it's sending out the wrong message to children. I thought it was sending out the message that you shouldn't be fat. Another report shows the staggering cost to the NHS of gambling, particularly online and particularly with young people. But first, Dominic Cummings. He's been talking for hours in that Commons committee, machine-gunning everybody in his sights. The Prime Minister, the Health Secretary in particular, are singled out by Dominic Cummings for criticism. What will you make of what he had to say? So finally, Dominic Cummings unleashed a series of well-trailed but bombshell claims about the government's handling of the pandemic. He was giving evidence to the Joint Inquiry of the Health and Science and Technology Committees this morning. Cummings apologised for his own mistakes, saying the government failed when people needed it most, saying Boris Johnson wasn't fit to be Prime Minister, and he said Health Secretary Matt Hancock should have been sacked because he lied 15 to 20 times. I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's Deputy Political Editor, John Stevens, who's been watching it. More devastating than you thought, John? What's your view?
Well, I mean, a lot of the things we already knew, that the government was ill-prepared for coronavirus, that they moved too slow at the start and things were chaotic inside Downing Street. We knew all of those things in advance, but what they've been able to do is kind of give some of that detail from behind the curtain and settle some scores whilst he's been doing that. You know, you've seen him attack Boris Johnson, Carrie Simmons, Mark Sedwell, he was the Cabinet Secretary, and Matt Hancock, who seems to have the biggest hammering that he really seems to have taken against Matt Hancock. And as you say, said that he told the Prime Minister many times that he should be sacked.
He's not provided, and he was asked more than once, any texts or written confirmation, John, of these claims. Is he likely to?
Well, at one point in the committee hearing, they did say, you know, are you able to give us WhatsApp messages between you and the Prime Minister? And Dominic Cummings said he was able to do that. So I think that things won't just be over today, that this will carry on rumbling on, that there are further revelations to come out, including these sorts of messages. I mean, I think people in government will be slightly nervous looking through WhatsApp messages, exchanges that they've had with Dominic Cummings, thinking, oh my goodness, what if this comes out into the public domain?
What do you think the most damaging claim was by Cummings today?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, there was so many different bits, but so far we've not had one kind of killer moment that made you think, oh my goodness, this is going to bring the government down. And you know, because he's attacked so many different people, you know, part of it has been almost quite helpful for Boris Johnson that he's gone so strong against the scientists, saying they just didn't understand what they were facing at the start, their advice was bad, that even though Dominic Cummings is clearly no fan of Boris Johnson anymore, it almost gives Downing Street the excuse that, you know, he was dealing with this advice from the scientists, which wasn't always right, but he was doing his best in a kind of very difficult moment.
There was a very odd claim that the Prime Minister wanted Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer, to inject him in public with some coronavirus or something like that anyway, to show it was no more dangerous than swine flu. That was a new one on me.
Yeah, so that was new, you know, and I think his point was basically that Boris Johnson just wasn't taking this seriously, didn't see it as anything more than a scare story. And when he was asked about how Boris Johnson, as we know, missed a lot of those COBRA meetings back last February, right at the start of the pandemic, Dominic Cummings said it would almost have been unhelpful if Boris Johnson had attended those COBRA meetings because he just wasn't taking it very seriously, that there'd be no point having a meeting chaired by him when he just thought coronavirus was something that was going to come and go and it wasn't actually going to do much harm.
And Cummings never went to the meetings either, did he?
I think he did go to some of them, is what people in government are saying, although he did say today that he did avoid a lot of them because he thought they were a waste of time and just people going through PowerPoint slides.
Remind me what was said about the Cabinet Secretary, Mark Sedwell, something quite also fairly outlandish.
Yeah, so he said that back at the start of last year, Mark Sedwell, the Cabinet Secretary, was urging Boris Johnson to go out there and kind of compare it to chickenpox. and suggest that people should have chickenpox parties and kind of, you know, if you were young and fit, you may as well get coronavirus, get it over and done with, and then we'd build up a herd immunity. But obviously, as we know, that they realised that would be a big mistake because of the how dangerous coronavirus was and how quickly it was spreading, whereas chickenpox, you don't see it spreading on such the same scale.
And what of the big, heavily trailed in advance that he was going to say that the government policy, John, was herd immunity? We know that Cummings said that the Prime Minister said most people who are dying of this are over 80. Did that charge about herd immunity, did it stack up? It didn't seem to me.
Well, I think the thing, the problem on the herd immunity stuff is that it gets slightly complicated on whether the government were deliberately going for this strategy or whether it was just kind of a side effect that they thought, you know, there's nothing we can do, that, but we will end up with the country building up herd immunity. So I think that's one of the areas where it gets a slightly bit confusing. I think a lot of the public will just have switched off.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that, John. At Primes' questions, I thought the Prime Minister batted it all away rather effortlessly. Keir Starmer, the forensic lawyer, big moment for him. I don't think he asked a killer question.
I don't think so. I agree with you. And if you look at back at the last few weeks, you have things that came out, like the bodies piled high comment, which was first reported in the Mail. And you saw that did cause a row for a few days. Then when it came to the local elections the next week, Boris Johnson still kind of triumphed and it didn't actually knock him in the polls. So I think this is obviously going to cause big rows for the next few days. I think it is damaging for the government what has come out at this hearing, but I don't think it's going to be the end of Boris Johnson's premiership by any means.
No, and I say you just sense that still announcing today isn't it, that people aged 30 to 32 can apply for the vaccination. That's perhaps what people are more focused on now. And of course, the final lifting of the lockdown on June the 21st.
Yeah, and when you saw Matt Hancock this morning as he left his home going for a jog, he was asked about the Dominic Cummings thing. And that's the thing he mentioned, was opening up the vaccines to everyone over 30. That's certainly what the government's hoping people will be thinking about rather than Dominic Cummings.
Fascinating stuff. That's John Stevens, who'll be writing all about this in the paper tomorrow. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So Britain's addiction to gambling is costing taxpayers £1.2 billion a year. That's according to research commissioned by peers in the House of Lords. The research found the NHS is footing a staggering bill of £760 million to treat those suffering from gambling addiction, with crime, joblessness and homelessness caused by gambling, leading to further costs of up to £410 million. I'm joined now by Lord Foster of Bath. He's chairman of Peers for Gambling Reform and joins me now. Lord Foster, these figures are appalling. And do we think many of the people caught up in this are possibly young people?
The staggering thing is that it is illegal for children to gamble. And yet the recent figures show that something like 60,000 children are classed as being problem gamblers. And so one of the big things that we're looking at is ways in which we can take further action to try and stop the involvement of young people in gambling. But you're quite right. The costs of gambling harm in this country are astronomical. And yet, in truth, they really should be very much higher, because the proportion of people who have got serious gambling problems who are being provided with help is very much smaller than it should be. And in fact, if you look at the fact that there are more people suffering from gambling-related harm than from drug-related harm, and yet the money spent on treatment for drug-related harm is much greater than for gambling-related harm, then you begin to see that although the figures are astronomical, you could almost argue they should be higher, because we should be providing more treatment, more support for people with gambling-related harm.
A lot of the problem, of course, Lord Foster, it's online gambling. Gone are the days when we used to see particularly men crowded into a bookies, smoking their roll-up cigarettes, waging bets on the 3:15 at Lingfield. It's gambling online on all sorts of issues, from who's going to score in a football match to who's going to win a football match. That you can, it seems now you can gamble online on just about anything, and it's very hard to regulate it and control it.
Well, it does seem from your description of what happens in a bookies shop that you have good experience of it. but you are quite right.
Only at the Grand National. Only at the Grand National.
But, I mean, if you think about it, two things are really important. The first is that if you go into a bookies shop and you put a bet on, you then have to wait before the result comes before you put your next bet on. There is at least quite a gap between one bit of gambling and the next bit of gambling. If you gamble online, you can now gamble 24/7 in a totally unsupervised situation, and also on games where there are no statutory limits on either the level of stake or prize or even the speed of play. And for that reason, there is real concern about the higher levels of addictiveness of online gambling, which has increased significantly, not least because of the pandemic in recent years, to the extent that we now know something like 40% of gambling and rising is online gambling. And the second point is very simply that the major legislation that determines the rules around gambling was the 2005 Gambling Act. Didn't actually come into force until 2007, but that was prior to the appearance of the first iPhone. So what we have is legislation that was designed for an analog world now trying to operate in a digital world, which is another reason why we desperately need to get on with the gambling review that the government rightly has announced, so that we can look at the measures needed to reduce gambling harm in this country, including for young people.
And one of the things you're already calling for, even before that review comes out, Lord Foster, is mandatory affordability checks and a ban on gambling sponsorship.
Yeah. And a number of other things, like limits on the stakes and prizes and speed of play on online games, the introduction of a genuine gambling ombudsman, and a number of other measures. But if you look at those measures you referred to, affordability. If I want to buy a house, people check whether or not I can afford the repayments. If I take out a bank loan, people look at whether I can afford to make the repayments. And if people want to gamble at high levels, then it seems to me perfectly reasonable that there should be checks on whether or not you can afford to do it. Because if you fail to do it, it's not only you that will be harmed, but very often other members of your family. We know, for instance, that something like 2 million people in this country are currently affected by gambling harm, even if they themselves are not necessarily a gambling addict. And so affordability checks are something that seems pretty obvious, and yet it's already a sort of requirement by the Gambling Commission. The gambling companies are meant to know their customers and take steps. The problem is we haven't really agreed how we should do it and ensure that it's the same system that applies across all the different gambling operators. So what we're pressing for is beefing up what currently exists and ensuring that it's something that all operators do in much the same way.
Very interesting. Can I ask you just finally, Lord Foster, do you ever gamble? Do you have a little flutter anytime?
I haven't for a very long time. You reminded me when you made reference to the Grand National as your own. I've certainly done that, but not actually in recent years. I've only bought one lottery ticket, which is in the first week the lottery came out. But the crucial thing to say is I'm not opposed to gambling.
No.
I think it is really important, and members of Peers for Gambling Reform and certainly the House of Lords Select Committee on Gambling, we were absolutely clear about this. It is a leisure pursuit that many people enjoy, but we want them to be able to do it safely. And at the moment, the evidence is very clear with, you know, something like 400,000 gambling addicts in the UK, as I say, 60,000 children. We know tragically that there is, on average, one gambling-related suicide every single day in the UK. We need to take action to try and reduce that number quite significantly, if we possibly can, but still enable people to enjoy their flutter on the Grand National or whatever.
All right, that's Lord Foster of Bath. He is the chairman of Peers for Gambling Reform. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and lots more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Beano character Fatty is in future to be known as Freddy, so that his name doesn't upset youngsters who might be struggling with weight issues. Now, the Bass Street Kids were created in 1954, and Fatty has been in the comic for 67 years. Deborah Watson of eating disorder charity Wednesday's Child has argued that names such as Fatty can lead to children and adults developing poor relationships with food. She joins me now. Debbie, I can remember reading Beano as a child, and I don't remember of the Fatty character putting me off my food.
That's really true, Andrew. There will be people out there who won't be at all impacted by the labels passed on to them or assertions or insinuations around their food and weight. But we also know, as an eating disorder organisation, we speak to an awful lot of people where the very seed of their eating disorder has manifested from something that happened around the way they were labelled at that point in their childhood. So while we would never say that derogatory comments about a person's size are the only thing that gives way to an eating disorder, we do know that for an awful lot of people, it starts in that place. So I guess one of the reasons why it's really good that Bass Street Boys are making this move is just that it reflects this need that we have in cultural society right now, is to reconsider what are the labels that we pass on to people and could they impact on people's self-esteem and mental well-being.
But isn't there another argument, Debbie, that actually having a fat child in the comic, a child who's perhaps lampooned by the other kids in the gang, and so that's saying to kids that being fat isn't good?
I think actually one of the things I would say that I think is really important about this opportunity that the comic has got right now is to rethink the way storylines reflect the shape and size of all sorts of individuals, because the thing that we recognise as an eating disorder organisation is this incredibly distressing mental illness, which is the most severe of all psychiatric mental illnesses and leads to has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness. Actually, with eating disorders, you can be of any size body and have an eating disorder. So actually, you're very right that it is important that we reflect all shapes and sizes of individuals via a comic.
Have you got evidence, Debbie, that shows that the labelling of people has impacted on children?
Yes, for sure. And during the pandemic, we've been seeing a huge surge. So we've gone up 100% on referrals through this last year. And so right now we're helping people from as young as 7 through to 74-year-olds. And I would say in a good sort of 65% people beyond, it has manifested in how they were talked about around their sort of weight and perception of their body image when they were younger. And as I say, that's not always true. So we get people that are impacted and suffer from an eating disorder much later in life because of stresses or other triggers that come along. But for a lot of people, it is to do with how their shape and size was perceived. And it can manifest at a very young age and then resurface later in life.
And when we talk about eating disorders, particularly with children, Debbie, are we talking often they're eating too much, or is it just as much it could be anorexic conditions?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Andrew. Actually, often when we hear the label eating disorder, we think of restrictive eating disorders. So, as you rightly say, anorexia nervosa, which would be most commonly associated with somebody having a skeletal figure being very, very underweight. But actually, people with eating disorder with anorexia are actually in the small percentage of people with eating disorders. We often see far more of people with bulimia, binge eating disorder, or something called ARFID, which is an avoidant restrictive food disorder. So, and the people people that experience those sorts of eating disorders may not have a tiny, tiny body. They may overeat in certain episodes throughout their day, and they do so in a discreet, in a private way. And it's the deceit and that secrecy that becomes that harmful relationship around food. And it's even more challenging for that person to reach out for help, because they feel ashamed, and then they feel stigmatized, and they feel if they were to go to a healthcare professional and say, I'm struggling with eating, I've got a disordered relationship with eating, there is still a fear that even a GP, a healthcare professional, might look at them and think, well, you don't represent in a typical fashion of somebody with an eating disorder. So it's really, really important that we do challenge the myth that anybody with an eating disorder must be in a tiny body, because it's just not the case.
Very interesting. That's Debbie Watson. She's from the eating disorder charity Wednesday's Child. Thanks for joining us. Now it's time for our regular sports update with Matt Gatwood, the deputy sports editor at the Daily Mail. So, Southgate, the England manager, worried over the England squad. What's this for?
Yeah, so we got the Euros. You know, we got the Euros coming up this summer. Delayed.
Can't wait.
Euro 2020, which they're still insisting on calling it, even though it's been put back a year to Euro 2021, which it should be, but it's Euro 2020. It's this summer.
Right.
Put back. Squad, Southgate was due to name his 26-man squad yesterday. He had to name a larger squad, a 33-man squad instead, because he felt that he still needed to give himself some time to learn about the injuries to the various players. So he's now going to announce his 26-man squad next week, because he's still in the dark over certain players. So Harry Maguire, for example, who would be his starting defender, who plays for Manchester United, is injured. Manchester United haven't been forthcoming with Southgate about how bad their injury is, amazingly, because they're playing in the Europa League final tonight and they want to keep it under wraps, which seems like a very strange
thing. And Southgate's not playing, is he, in the game tonight?
Maguire's not playing, in the game. So very odd that Manchester United wouldn't share the information about, you know, their centre-half with the England manager, who needs to know. So he was a bit miffed about that when he was speaking yesterday. He's also got concerns over Jordan Henderson, the Liverpool player, who would be a guaranteed starter. Someone like Jack Grealish has only just come back to fitness. So he's got lots of issues, lots of fitness injuries, lots of things he needs to work out. And it was telling that yesterday Southgate was quite, well, reasonably downbeat about the situation that he's in. Before Russia, the last World Cup, when obviously England got to the semi-finals, he said that the build-up was absolutely smooth. He knew his squad, everyone was fit, he knew he was on the reserve list, and it was all sort of plain sailing leading into the tournament. And of course, England did well. This time he says there's lots of bumps in the road. So I don't know, you know, hopefully some of these players will be fit, or they'll be definitely ruled out and he'll know where he's at next week. But
when does the tournament start?
So not until mid-June.
Right.
So he's got a few weeks. He's got like 3 weeks. But obviously there's Manchester United players playing tonight in the Europa League final. And then on Saturday you've got Chelsea and Manchester City.
In the Champions League
final. So obviously Southgate will be watching that through his fingers, hoping that...
worrying that players might get injured.
Yeah, so there's about 10 players playing in that game who could get injured.
So perversely, the fact that British clubs, English clubs, did so well in the European competitions has adversely impacted the national team.
Absolutely.
Because they're playing extra matches, more susceptible to bumps and scrapes and all the rest of it.
Exactly. So France, for example, have got all their players together now. They know where they're at. They know who's fit, who's injured. They're not worrying over last minute.
They beat us anyway, weren't
they? Possibly. We'll see it. But yes, they're a strong team. So yeah, Southgate said that that himself yesterday. They're in the worst position of all the countries who are going to the Euros, because they don't know quite where they're at.
And talking of Europe, tonight Manchester United are playing...
So tonight Manchester United are playing Villarreal in the Europa League final.
In what country is that taking place?
So that is in Poland, in Gdansk.
Obviously.
Of course, yeah.
So ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, that's what they do with these finals.
It's madness. Why can't it be in either England or wherever this other team?
Because that would give an advantage to one of the teams. So they always pick at the start of the tournament, they say, this is where the final is.
Hang on, Chelsea and Manchester City, that could be played at Wembley.
And yet
that's being played in Portugal, isn't it?
Yeah, so that was moved from where it was meant to be in Turkey.
That really is stupid.
That was a bit daft. But then they said that the British government couldn't give them the guarantees they wanted about bringing the people in and
the
not having to quarantine.
The 2,000 officials that wanted jolly.
Exactly, you remember.
Right, so will they win tonight, United?
So United are heavy favourites. Right. They should beat Villarreal, who are the fifth, sixth best team in Spain this season from where they finished. So they should beat them. They've obviously got, you know, it's Manchester United, they're the biggest biggest club in the world, or so they say, and they've obviously got, you know, players who cost a lot more money than the Villarreal players, who are on a lot more money, and therefore they are favourites to win. The manager of Villarreal is Unai Emery, who you'll remember used to be the manager of Arsenal very briefly before we booted him out.
Right, yeah.
But he's got a great record in the Europa League, so he's won it four times already. So he would want to add one more, and you know, you never know.
Well, it's a one-off game. It's that point in the programme, Matt. You know what I'm going to ask you? Prediction for the match.
Well,
come
I always get these right. So yeah. I'm going to go for a Manchester United victory, 3-0.
3-0. Yep. Okay. Well, we'll test you out on that tomorrow. And finally, Wimbledon plans causing a stir. Is that my beloved tennis tournament?
Yeah, so nice little story this, which was exclusive in today's Sports Mail, was that all the Wimbledon players, so normally the players who turn up at Wimbledon, they hire out these fancy houses in and around southwest London in the Wimbledon area, and they come and go as they please, wander into the practice courts, have a knock, and then go and play their games, and then they go home. Obviously, they can't do that this time because of quarantining and because of bubbles and because they security breaches in terms of bringing COVID in and out. So they're all staying in hotels now, but what's causing a bit of a stir is the best players have been given the best suites at the Park Plaza Hotel, which is in town, actually. So I think it's sort of Westminster way.
Right. I know it. I've been there, yeah.
Yeah, do you know the one? Massive
it's huge. It's not particularly nice, actually.
Well, no, but it's big, and I think that's the main thing. And all the best players being given the suites, so the fancy room. So Roger Federer will be in a nice suite, and the lesser players will be in the smaller room, so they'll be in the broom cupboard. So it's now, you know, you could argue, well, you know, Roger Federer deserves to be in the suite.
Yes,
he's a better player. Well, you would say that
he's a champ.
You're a big Federer fan.
Yeah,
but if you're one of the lesser players, you might look up to the top floor and wonder why you can't have a slightly bigger room. So that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to keep them all in these in the Park Plaza. Then they'll all be ferried in and out of Wimbledon via via car.
Do they
and then
know
straight
anything?
Back to the hotel.
Do the Wimbledon authorities not know about our London roads?
Yeah,
which are a car park because of Sadiq Khan shoving all those cycle superhighways and traffic slowing down measures. I mean, they're going to turn up late for the matches, aren't they?
I'll tell you what, it's a very good point. I mean, you know, if there's nothing on the road, what's that, half an hour journey? But with traffic, you know, you're looking at an hour and a half, 2 hour journey.
And if it rains?
And so they can't exactly come back and forth. So it will definitely be a talking point. And they can't shut down the roads because that would cause carnage, as you say, because it's gridlock anyway at the best of times. So, yeah, it's going to be difficult.
I predict trouble ahead with that.
I think you might be right.
And Sadiq Khan's, he seems to think slowing down cars is his mission in life as Mayor of London.
Maybe they should all cycle from the Park Plaza to Wimbledon. Probably be quicker.
There's plenty of cycle highways, aren't there? So that would be all right. All right, that's Matt Gatwood. Remember, 3-0 Manchester United, he's predicted. We'll see about that tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Could another curable condition lie behind some cases of irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS as it's known? Gut complaints apparently account for 1 in 5 GP consultations, and IBS is thought to affect up to 14 million people in the UK. But could some cases be due to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is known as SIBO? I'm joined by Good Health writer Joe Waters, who's co-author of the book What's Up With Your Gut, which she wrote with Professor Julian Waters. Joe, welcome. I had absolutely no idea so many people have bad guts.
Yes, it's such a common problem. You know, if you look at the Daily Mail message board today, I think last count there are about 780 comments with people, you know, very similar stories to the man in the story today. Diagnosed for many years with IBS and actually turned up to have something entirely different, which was treatable.
And essentially, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. This occurs when there's too much bacteria in the small intestine, which ferments, producing gases, and then causes symptoms in the upper end of the digestive tract. And that's quite common too.
Apparently, it can be at both ends. You know, so you can get the kind of the acid reflux type symptoms, but also if it's lower in the gut, you'd get kind of diarrhea and stomach pain, that kind of thing. Which, again, you know, it's obviously an overlap with IBS.
And why do so many of us get afflicted with this? Is there a cause, a common cause?
There's supposed to be a number of causes. One of them might be that you've had previous gastric surgery. So if you've had, something like inflammatory bowel disease and you've had surgery. So that's obviously not a lot of people. But another one is taking drugs called proton pump inhibitors, PPIs. These are incredibly commonly prescribed drugs. A very common one is omeprazole, and that's prescribed for acid reflux, but it's also in some studies it's been associated with a quite significant increased risk of developing SIBO. So that's another cause. Another one is, ironically, having a very strong course of antibiotics. So it can wipe out kind of good bacteria and cause bad ones to grow in the wrong place. So there are a number of causes, yeah.
Acid reflux, that's something I hear more and more about as I get older. Is that because as we get older, we're more likely to be prone to a condition like acid reflux?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, it's associated with aging. And also being overweight and kind of poor diet, poor lifestyle issues, really. But also, there are millions of people taking these PPI drugs.
Which they can buy those over-the-counter, can they?
Some of them are available over-the-counter. Most people will get them on prescription.
And yet, in a sense, you're saying that they're part of the problem?
Yes, yeah. And so, you're taking a drug to treat one type of gut symptom, and it causes other symptoms.
Can't the medics see that and find another drug to prescribe or perhaps another way to treat the ailment?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of medics are coming round to this, giving people lifestyle advice, telling them not to eat sort of too close to bedtime, not have greasy foods, lose some weight. You know, this is a big problem in the UK. We've got so many overweight and obese people. So, to be fair, they do try those things, but it's whether the patients actually follow the advice. So then, the next step would be a PPI, which I guess some people see as a sort of, easy ticket out of their symptoms, but actually they're probably unaware that they're associated with other gut symptoms.
Is alcohol a factor in this condition as well? Sometimes would you say, Jo?
In acid reflux, yeah, I think so. That can be, yeah, not in SIBO particularly, no. But yeah, drinking, all the things we do, greasy food, eating too close to bedtime. They've got lots of useful advice you can have, not wearing too tight a white waistband on your trousers and things like that. That might be a first step, or, propping up your head at night, those kind of things. And people do try those, but if they don't work, they do move on to PPI. I would say thousands of people self-medicate with just antacid remedies over the counter as well. I wouldn't blame it all on GPs. I think it's a lot of us are living very unhealthy lifestyles.
Yeah, probably me too, I'm thinking here. I'm just thinking, do I recognise some of these symptoms? And I'm thinking, I do eat sometimes too late at night, and that's not good. If there was one piece of really important advice, Jo, you'd give to people listening who might think, hey, that's me, I've got this irritable stomach, irritable bowel syndrome, what would you say the most important thing is?
I mean, I would go and see your GP. I think too many people put up with these things and suffer in silence for many years, and they never get really to the bottom of what's up with their gut, which is when Julian and I wrote the book about that, because we just kept coming across all these cases where people suffered in silence. But I think the important thing is see your GP. I mean, there are new guidelines that have just come out on IBS, and they recommend that, there are standard tests that you have to eliminate some of these conditions. It's interesting they don't include SIBO though. I think you would be more likely to get that from a referral to secondary care. But if you don't respond to any of the treatments they prescribe you in general practice for IBS, or your symptoms are very severe, you can request a second opinion and be referred on to a gastroenterologist. So, if you're really suffering, that's what I'd recommend.
Well, good advice. That's the good health writer, Jo Waters, who's co-author of the book, What's Up With Your Gut, which she wrote with Professor Julian Waters. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.